The history of the Jewish people is a sweeping narrative of struggle and strength. Now, art historian and award-winning author Simon Shama has given us a five-part PBS series and a two-volume history of the Jewish people told through their words, their art, and their objects. The first volume, called The Story of the Jews, Finding the Words, 1000 BC to 1492 AD, is just out from Echo, and the companion PBS series premieres tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Channel 13. I'm pleased that all of that brings Simon Shama back to our show. Hello.
Hello.
How had the Jews been referred to before 1000 BC when you begin your book?
How were they? I'm sorry.
Jews before 1000?
Oh, no. In fact, actually, the first mention of anything resembling a Jew, I suppose, is a 13th century BC inscription by the pharaoh Meneptah, which refers to Israel and Israelites. So it says the seed of Israel is scattered. So this terminology is, that's a very rabbinical of you, Leonard, not surprisingly. The terminology is an occasion for great complication and discussion. In fact, the colony of mercenary soldiers, who I talk about as Jewish, in Egypt in the 5th century BC, are called in Aramaic the Haile HaYehuda, in other words, the Judean troop. So the issue about when or not you are self-consciously a Jew is a big and dangerous issue in scholarship right now.
And the matter of the seed being scattered is there right from the start.
It's not good, is it? It's from the beginning, Tsuras, Tsuras, Tsuras. rather significantly, since it's an Egyptian description, it's a description of the Israelites being vanquished, whereas the Exodus story, written half a millennium later, is just the opposite.
You say that the fact that many Jews were literate set them apart as a people. Why were they more literate than most of their neighbors?
Well, it's unclear about how widespread literacy was in West Semitic Phoenician culture, something like that. What has been made quite clear, I think, by brilliant scholarship on epigraphy, which everybody out there is in fact the science of inscriptions. If you think that's dry as dust, just dip into it. Perhaps through my bibliography, because it's one of the most dazzling disciplines which I've encountered for a long time. And the epigraphers have discovered ABC. Yeah, epigraphy, which is, I know, nothing to do with pigs.
It doesn't sound kosher to me.
No, it doesn't sound kosher, does it? The epigraphers have found these ABCDs, in other words, they're inscriptions set into walls of buildings, which are learning alphabets. And quite soon after, the 22-letter linear alphabet was introduced. When you think about it, it's a whole lot easier to actually master that kind of alphabet than either some kind of linear B or Egyptian hieroglyphs. So what had been thought originally to be the case, that the Bible was written by a small elite of scribes, now, I'm sure, still was sort of edited and redacted, but what they did was sort of import the earthy vernacular which was available to people other than from the scribal class. And in the book, alas, not in the program, we did film it and there wasn't room for it, there are all sorts of inscriptions. One is from this very rough, tough NCO, one of the Judean forts holding out against the Babylonians, whose name is Hoshayahu and calls himself a dog or a son of a dog, complaining to his rather stuck-up senior officer that the officer assumes he's illiterate. And he said, well, yes, all very well about, you know, can I see smoke from other forts, but what really upset me was that you said, have someone read this to you. He's a son of a dog. Not only can I read it, I don't know about you, but I can remember every single last word once I've read it, and that is just wonderful.
Now, was the Jewish Bible the first written history or attempt at written history?
Well, no.
There
are lots and lots of triumphalist histories. What is extraordinary about the Hebrew Bible are two things, I think, is that they don't just hymn the prowess of kings and gods. Moses is neither. He has a close relationship with the Almighty. But many subsequent generations say the extraordinary thing about Moses is that he is a so-called civil magistrate. He is absolutely not a king.
Even though he's brought up as a prince.
Well, that's even more. This is goes to the heart of the peculiarity of Jewish self-consciousness. Is it a good idea to have a royal state or not? Well, King David had all these peccadilloes. Solomon, you know, gets into trouble in other ways. So there is this extraordinary sense, actually, that raw, imperfect humanity speaks back to God. Jonah complains, kvetches to God, you know, can't he destroy at least some of the Ninevites since he's just spent the last weekend in the belly of a fish. Job has this, you know, merciless kind of back and forth. So there's this extraordinary sense in which God is in the human world, and the human world's also on this kind of personal, difficult, complicated relationship with a problematic crosspatch of a God.
There's been a stereotype that Jews are people apart, but through much of this book, you write about how they mingled and assimilated with the cultures around them.
Yeah, but I just think historically the Jews have never been a people apart. Even if you think about those parts of the Bible which are about actually being apart. Again, for example, the Song of the Sea that celebrates the destruction of the Egyptians in the Red Sea. It is very close to other non-Jewish epics of the storm god parting the waters and so on, Phoenician ones particularly. But what I really wanted to say in the book, and I do in the series as well, the assumption is that the more deeply involved in other cultures the Jews are going to be, the more obviously they're going to be on the highway to assimilation. I wanted to say that is not always the case. For example, in the book, I got very interested in the illumination of late medieval Bibles. Not just, we think of the Haggadah, the part we're about to read, as being the only illustrated sacred book, but not true. The Middle Ages, both in the Ashkenazi northern European world and the Sephardi world, are full of machzorim, festival prayer books, daily prayer books, and the Bible above all, which are full of pictures and pictures of people as well. And some of those were done by Christian scribes, and Christian scribes taught Jewish scribes how to do it. That we know. That's an example where the more, you know, wired you are to your local culture, the more intensely Jewish you might be, but paradoxically.
But don't the Jews have an iconoclastic art tradition? Because the Ten Commandments forbid making graven images of God, and the Old Testament states that God made mankind in his own image.
Right. Well,
has led Muslims to become such great abstract artists.
Yes, exactly. And, this is, an extraordinary misconception, actually, again, historically. The Second Commandment is mostly read for the first 500 years of the existence of synagogues. In other words, from 70 AD on to almost the rise of Islam, which makes you think again, the Second Commandment was interpreted as a prohibition on sculpture, or if on painting, then of likenesses of God. What is extraordinary about, we have now archaeological excavations of synagogue after synagogue, from the Maghreb right through to Syria, the Durieropos synagogue, which was covered in wall paintings, is that every single synagogue we know about have these ravishing mosaic floors, which not only have images of the temple, but also signs of the zodiac, what I call the calendar girls, half-dressed, very bling-heavy, representing Tevet and Tammuz. And people actually didn't stand on these mosaics. They stood around the perimeter of the synagogue. I mean, Jewish art history, which was once an oxymoron, is now one of the most interesting and gripping and flourishing disciplines there is.
Well, what came first, those mosaics or the mosaics that we find in ancient Greece and in Rome?
Oh, I think again, another example, we adapted those for synagogue use. There's no doubt about it. What's incredibly interesting, this is one place we couldn't film, small matter of the Syrian civil war. I wanted actually to charter a little helicopter, but I'm famous for many physical disasters on film sheets. BBC wouldn't let me go near it. But also at Durieropos, you actually have Christian iconography, Christian chapels, and this fantastic, spectacular Jewish synagogue with paintings of David happening at exactly the same time. They're in dialogue with each other. Whose David is it really? Is it David that's the prophet of Christ? Or is it, excuse me, our David who is... So they're doing this kind of standoff in these amazing paintings.
Well, it's often been pointed out that many of the Christian holidays coincide with pagan holidays,
right?
Christmas, the winter solstice, et cetera, yes. Easter, the spring solstice. What about the Jewish traditions, the 8 days of Passover? Is that something that—
8 days of Hanukkah,
Hanukkah,
yes.
Yeah, is that—
Yeah, no, I mean, Hanukkah is officially instituted state religion, the Hasmoneans, which is why the rabbis are leery of it. The Hasmoneans wanted those 8 days to be the same period as Tabernacles, as Sukkot, which is 8 days as well. And the rabbis weren't going for it. But there is an extraordinary dialogue again between Passover and Easter. We don't actually have a Seder service until after the Easter story is really instituted. So who exactly was copying who remains a very interesting—
So all those people who have told me that the Last Supper was actually a Seder were getting it wrong?
It can't have been. They have got it wrong.
My guest is Simon Sharma. His the first of a two-volume series on the story of the Jews, this one, Finding the Words, 1000 BC to 1492 AD, just been published by Echo. There's also a television series which does not follow the same structure as the books. The books are—
No, you know, that's why I do it, Leonard. I mean, the book is a wonderful place where you can be digressive, expansive. You know, another digression, Mr. Sharma? Surely not.
We'll be back with more right after this. We are back with Simon Sharma, who's University Professor of Art History and History at Columbia University. His latest book is The Story of the Jews, Finding the Words, 1000 BC to 1492 AD. It has nothing to do with Columbus. It is published by Echo. And as I said, you're an art historian.
It's actually, there is something to do with Columbus.
Well, yeah, no, we'll get to that. No, I know.
A tiny, tiny detail.
But 1492, the first thing people think of is Columbus. They don't think of also the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. Much of the Jewish history and culture has been about words. So has the artistic aspect been overlooked?
Well, again, as I said, it's a really flourishing discipline, but it had to struggle. As a matter of fact, the first book I know of, and I bet one of your listeners will take me up, was Cecil Roth wrote a book on Jewish art, the great, formidable British historian of the Jews, whose half book, Unfinished, I was actually commissioned to complete 40 years ago, and I felt there was absolutely no way I could do it. You know, I wasn't the right person to do that for all kinds of reasons, but he really started that off. And but there are people, for example, the Duri Oropos wall paintings we spoke about. There was a fantastic essay by Maya Shapiro, of all people. You know, and you think about it, he was the first, but that lost. I mean, he didn't actually publish it in any anthology. And it is exactly for the reason. But the sense in which, actually, I would say this, that some of the most powerful Jewish art has involved text as well. Those illuminated manuscripts think very hard about the way the letters perform. I talk in the book about, and a bit in the film, about the pre-Kabbalistic mystical book, which is so wonderful, called the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, in which God actually creates the physical world out of letters. So the kind of free flow, which we think of as, you know, super modernist, between writing and picturing, it has this wonderful marriage in Jewish culture.
Well, also numbers are written with Hebrew letters.
Indeed,
which is different than in most other cultures.
You find sometimes almost subliminally these things happening together. In the Cairo Geniza, when we were filming, when I was thinking this enormous repository of medieval manuscripts, of every Hebrew manuscripts, of Jewish manuscripts, every conceivable kind of document to do with the working as well as the sacred life, there was a little ABC learning page from a child, probably about 4 or 5, and he or she was doing the Aleph Bet Gimel, and under the Gimel she did a doodle of a camel, because it's like the Hebrew word for camel, Kamal. And I thought, that is absolutely wonderful, actually, that seemed to me picture, letter, number, all on that page of that small child.
Well, you seem to be intrigued throughout the book by tiny details like that. You have this sweeping narrative, and then you have the kid with the doodle of a camel, and you also include moments of humor like the surreptitious pickling that must have gone on during the Sabbath. But they are important to history as well.
I think so. I mean, this is, you know, I suppose, actually, if you want a grand sweep of the high points of Jewish thought, this may not be, you know, that certainly wouldn't be the first, but that's not really what I do. What I want to do is the interplay between someone like Moses Maimonides and also the kind of day-to-day, ordinary life of Jews. A lot of the Talmud, indeed the Mishnah, which came before it, but a lot of the Talmud, this immense commentary on how you recur, is to do with how we lead our daily life. And one of my favorite bits, since Passover is coming up, is that two rabbis are discussing what you can and can't eat on Passover. And they say, since young women use a kind of flour paste to as a depilatory, actually to rip the hairs off their legs, that's actually not kosher for Passover. Should they stop? And then these two old rabbis have this debate about what's really good for waxing, basically, and is it kosher? I mean, that is so Jewish, really.
There's another strain of this story, the paranoia about Jews that's developed throughout history. Is that woven into this history from its beginning as well? When did things like the blood libel begin?
Well, that begins in the High Middle Ages. So, no, the paranoia is not of our doing. And actually, what was kind of awful thing to discover all over again was how early the notion that Jews are busy kidnapping people and doing away with them. That starts in Rome before Christianity has anything to do with it. Tacitus believes this horrible story told by the second century Egyptian grammarian Appian that Jews are lying in wait to kidnap Greeks and then they fatten them up and then they kill him and eat him in some sort of secret conclave. So it happens very, very early on.
Early, before the Middle Ages, as I...
Sorry, now I was just going to say that one of the people in the first program that describes Jewish history as paranoia confirmed by history on our side, which has something to do with it. But that what happens in the Christian tradition is that once there's a real emphasis, not just on the salvific effect of Christ, but actually on his crucifixion in the High Middle Ages, those who are kind of physically responsible for the crucifixion develop awful demonologies about Jews doing abducting small children and doing mock crucifixions and so on.
The first full manuscript of the Talmud is from the 14th century. Had pieces of it been written down before that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes, the Talmud is actually completed. Vast parts of it are available much, much earlier than that.
I'd always assumed it had been oral, been part of the oral tradition.
No, I mean, they call themselves the oral tradition. No, there are huge commentaries. The Mishnah is completed in pretty much the 2nd century AD, and the Talmud itself, the Talmud Babli, in the 9th century. So manuscript versions of it were circulating long in advance of that.
What about the work of Maimonides?
Well, he is extraordinary because actually he arrives at a point where he, because Judaism is about to be, as he knows, under severe pressure, particularly in the Christian as well as in the Islamic world, and literally the Talmud's going to be put on trial and will have to actually argue that it hadn't usurped the true Bible. Maimonides wants to use...
That was in Paris in 1240.
Yes, exactly so.
And then in Barcelona 1263.
Yes, exactly. All these extraordinary disputations when Jewish converts very often are hired by the church in order to demonstrate that basically the Bible had been hijacked by the Talmud. So Maimonides has to say, let's use our brains, our philosophy. God has given us our intellect to defend our sacred principles.
Now, 1492 is where you end this. Mm-hmm. Most people associate that with Columbus's journey to the New World. But it was also when Jews were expelled from Spain, a country that they had described as an earthly Eden. There had been persecutions before, hadn't there?
Oh, in Spain. I mean, yes, absolutely. I mean, it was described as an earthly Eden when it was Muslim Spain, by and large. There's a famous and beautiful letter describing Andalusia by Hasan ibn Shaprut, which describes when he's describing it to the king of Khazars in Jewish Crimea, by the way, out there. I actually think the solution to the Crimean problem is for the Israelis to actually occupy Crimea. Does that sound like a recipe for peace, everybody out
you
there?
Are, but you really are a troublemaker.
Moi? Surely not. No, 1391 is a year, 100 years before 1492, of terrible massacre in Spain.
But Ferdinand and Isabella decided to expel the Jews.
They do decide to expel the Jews.
Why then?
Well, because actually 100 years had lapsed in which 100,000 Jews who actually have been forcibly or decided to convert. The issue is, are they actually Christian or are they pretending? And Ferdinand and Isabella think that as long as there are open Jews in Spain, there's going to be backsliding. And of course, they're not wrong about that, actually.
When does the second volume come out?
In the autumn. Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you have the television series as well. It's a five-parter,
which has
a very different structure. As I said, you don't take this, you don't tell a story in a chronological way.
Well, there is some chronological spine, but instead of Moses right at the beginning, we have Sigmund Freud. Why not?
Simon Schumer will be speaking with Jonathan Safran Foer at the 92nd Street Y tonight at 8:15. For ticket information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, The Story of the Jews, Finding the Words, 1000 BC and to 1492 AD. It is published by Echo. The TV series is a five-parter.
Yes, it's two chunks, two hours tomorrow night, and then 3 hours, that's almost too many Jews, even for you and me, the following Tuesday.
Uh-huh. And do you like being a presenter on television?
I like making the films very much, yes. It's a collaborative craft, which sometimes is a wonderful thing to be part of.
Well, Simon, thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Actually, I think the book should have been a little longer.
Tell my publishers that. They're already fainting off stage.